Good evening. This is Bob Willard, and welcome to Profiles. This is our opportunity to visit with people who live or are visiting in South Central Indiana. Our guest today is John Rappaport, an IU graduate, and John is now or has been an incredibly successful writer and producer for television and motion pictures. John's credits include, now, are you ready for this? Night Court, Gung Ho, MASH, The Odd Couple, All in the Family, Maude, Lily Tomlin Special, and Rowan and Martin's Laugh-Ins, plus 23 network pilots. So here he is, back at IU after 36 years, back where it started. On the way, he's worked on three number one shows, written and produced the most watched program in television history, picked up 8 Emmy nominations, 4 People's Choice Awards, 5 Writers Guilds of America's nominations, a Golden Globe, residency in the National Association of Broadcasters and Producers of America Halls of Fame. So, John, welcome back to IU and to WFIU. Things have certainly changed since the days of the old Jordan Avenue Quonset Hut.
Yeah, it's been a long time in coming back. I've been back a lot recently, especially because my daughter is now a junior here. But I do like, in the introduction, the word has been was was used, although not in the specific descriptive tense. And I did most of those things that you talked about, I think, before I passed away.
You passed away a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I passed away. So I've just this is just a legacy of recording that I left on WFIU when I was here. So,
well, you were a disc jockey on WFIU, were you not?
Not merely.
Not merely. Okay.
But
I see a story coming on here. Well, of course.
Well, you want me to tell you stories, right? So because after having been, on the other side of the mic where you as you love to have throw a question out to somebody and they say, yeah. So yeah. I could give you, one of those. So tell me, John, where did you grow up? Chicago. So I'll try to elaborate. Basically, when I started out in IU as a business major. And after about a year, I ended up signing up for the IMU radio show, and I was a jazz freak at the time and played jazz there and was majoring in – ultimately switched my major to radio and TV before it became telecommunications. So – and it was in a Quonset hut on South Jordan, and FIU had a coverage of – it was 75,000 watts. I don't – what is it now? Still – yeah, and but huge coverage area back in the days, though, when 14 people were listening to FM, when we all could have bought an FM station for $20, but didn't, because obviously AM was the place to be. Thank goodness that hasn't changed. Anyway, they used to have the program format of WFIU was basically classical all day. Long, and at from 6 to 7, they had dinner music. So it was the Melocrino strings. And everyone spoke like this, and we all talked FM talk. And they asked me if I wanted to do a jazz show stripped across from 5 to 6 every day. And I said there's 2 conditions. One is that I can't do it every day because I would probably still be sleeping as a student.
Now, this is 5 or 6 in the afternoon.
Yeah, 5 or 6 in the afternoon. Yeah, oh, yeah. And this was back in probably 1959. Before electricity. So, most of the station was powered by hamster, I believe. But so they wanted to do a jazz show. So I had the format was that each day would be a different style of jazz. And in other words, Monday would be traditional. Tuesday was swing. Wednesday was modern, et cetera. And my other clever thing was that each program would be the theme song would be a jazz version in that whatever the style was for the day of Back Home Again in Indiana. So Stan Getz was the modern version, and Jimmy McPartlin was one. I had Dizzy Gillespie doing Back Home Again in Indiana. So that was it. But the other catch was I said, I'm not going to read that copy. I'm not – first of all, who could type it for me? That was a class, where they would do this stuff and they'd talk about Dmitri Rostropovich and all the West, right, or whatever it is. And you'd have said David Oistrakh. And so I said, I'm going to have to ad-lib this. You can't script jazz talk. So they gave me permission to ad lib. So I was the first person on WFIU allowed to actually say something that came from his mind instead of from a little page, because that was a whole that was the class. So you took continuity and you'd get graded on this, and then the announcers would come in and they would read the copy, and of course they would read it like this. And one time at the end of one of the shows, the symphony or whatever they were playing was ending, and the guy who was on the announcing at that time had to leave early, and he asked me if I would just close down for him. So I said, sure, as I was getting ready with my jazz stuff. It ended, and I probably said, this is, and you've been listening to the Beethoven Piano Concerto No. 2, Rudolf Serkin on piano. Well, and I went on anyway. So at the next day I came in, I did my jazz show. The next day the guy that was playing the classical music came in and says, what is this on piano? He was the pianist. This was not a jazz album. So that was WFIU in those days. But it was great because I had, you know, with students, and we got to learn stuff and make mistakes and be stupid. And we made documentaries on WTTV, which was the PBS station down here and was really the only television outlet. And, we did a lot of those documentaries, and I think they would probably now be called mockumentaries because we did a lot of fooling around with those. So those were the old days. And FM stations, you could, again, they were very cheap, and anyone who bought one in those days is now a multimillionaire. So that's probably more than you ever wanted to know.
Well, no, it's a long way from starting here in a Quonset hut. But you came to IU as a business major ended up in telecommunications.
Yeah, except it wasn't telecommunications. Yes. You know, now, it's also the sign of the times. It was originally called radio and television, and you couldn't even get a full major in that. So if you switched out of the business school, and by the way, at that time, if you wanted to get into the business school, you said, I want to get into the business school, and you were in. Now, as we discovered with my daughter, the Kelly School of Business is a fabulous school, and you have to pass requirements, and you have to really be admitted. It's right up there with Wharton. So the scene is quite different, and this school just keeps getting better and better, and I have this lifetime of love for Indiana University. So I started out in business, and I had to move to arts and sciences about in the middle of my sophomore year. And because I had taken a couple of psych courses and I kind of like that, that was my split major. You had to take another actual thing because radio and television, I mean, wasn't worthy of an entire major. So, and now I see it's telecommunications. And so that encompasses a lot of things. It has to do, if you majored in radio and television at Indiana back then, that meant you were either on the air or behind the scenes or in production, something or other. Now it could mean that you know how to program a cell phone. So, I don't know, there's a lot of statistics going on and a lot of things. And a lot of what I did then, is covered by the drama department and theater. So, again, times change. And
you went to L.A. and you were involved with some radio stations. How did you go from there to being involved in television? Where was the changeover?
Well, it actually started. That's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a disc jockey. And I worked, as I say, at the two stations down here and then moved up to the Chicago area, had a couple DJ shows. And one, I was working on one. It was a New Year's Eve night, it was actually New Year's morning at that point. I was coming back from a party in Chicago in a suit, back in days when you wore suits, and a tie. And I was on the Tri-State Toll Road in Illinois, got a flat tire, 3 o'clock in the morning, I had to change the tire in the blizzard, and with a suit on. If you've ever tried to like pick up a tire without clutching it to your clothes, that's another fun experience. So 3 days later, I quit my job as a DJ in the Chicago area and said I had been to California as a kid when I was 8 years old, and it was warm there. I went to Los Angeles, but it had nothing to do with wanting to be in show business or Hollywood, so to speak. It was just a warm town. And so I was out there, and I moved out there to see if I could get a job as a DJ, and not realizing that the competition out there was really amazing because you've got, besides the Hollywood, you've got all this talent that's there. And I was a guy at the time who was number one DJ in the area, and I turned on the radio when I first got in the car after getting off the plane. And I heard this guy with these incredible pipes, and he was hysterically funny, and his name was Gary Owens. And He dominated the afternoon radio scene. He had been down from San Francisco. And this was, again, on AM, KMPC AM, which was the number one station in town. There was a rock station at the time that was also doing very well. And just about everybody I heard was, like, by and large, either had great a great set of pipes, a great voice, or had a terrific personality. Never did get that disc jockey job. But I did end up writing some radio commercials for Mel Blanc. Had a radio thing where they did radio spots and little vignettes. So I was writing some of these things, did that, and one of the guys that did the voices for this was a nationally syndicated thing, was Gary Owens, at which point it was one of those situations where I introduced myself to him, and he wasn't, I was probably, I think, 25, and Gary was maybe 27 or 28, and we hit it off instantly, and we just did. He invited me to come over to KMPC, and we just did a bunch of wild tracks. Had the time of our lives, just improvising, and then I ended up doing voices for Gary while I was working at this other station in promotion at the time. So Gary ultimately introduced me to a guy with the William Morris Agency, who became my agent, and he was for 13 years, and. The agent was the one that subsequently, about a few months later, called and said they're looking for writers for Laugh-In.
Well, Gary Owens was involved with Laugh-In.
Gary, of course, Laugh-In had been on the air, you know, one half of a season and was like dynamite. I remember the first time that I recorded with Gary, we came over, went over to KMPC, and it was a Monday night, and Laugh-In was on, and we watched. And to me, a young kid from the Midwest, who this was the biggest star I had ever met, and there was Gary on television, on network television, on NBC, doing, oh, it's Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. And
he was the one that always had his ear cut.
He had his hand behind his ear. I was doing that again. That shows you how bright I am. I'm doing radio, and I'm doing visuals here for you. This was an immense charge for me to actually be with a guy who was on television. Subsequently, as I say, he got me the agent. The agent said, and Ronan Martin's Laugh-In was my favorite show. It was number one. It was a smash. And I said, they want to see some material. So I said, when do they want to see it? He said, tomorrow. So I went home and I threw down a whole bunch of stuff as fast as I could and do it. And I'd never really written. I had always written for myself, basically, when I would DJ, but I never wrote anything till I had done some stand-up, but I never liked doing the same routine more than once, so I much preferred emceeing. I've always been, as you can tell from going back to my WFIU days, I liked improvising and ad-libbing, and it did not require, of course, the discipline of writing, and, you know, that's discipline and procrastination. So I threw all of this stuff down on paper and handed it in to the agent, who turned it over to the Laugh-In folk. And I got a call a few days later saying they liked your material and they'd like you to interview with them, to have a meeting. And at the time, George Slaughter, who's still around, was the producer of this show. And so being a Chicago boy, I got ready for my interview. I put on a very nice sport coat and a white shirt and a tie and had short hair and walked in there looking like I was going for an advertising agency job on Michigan Avenue. And I walk into this building and there's these two guys with beards and sweatshirts and jeans. And I figured, I've blown this. You know, I look like somebody that's just, you know, auditioning for the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. So I had the interview, and it seemingly went okay, but I'm figuring, you know, what the heck, they're not going to hire somebody as ridiculous looking as this. So about a week later, I got a call from Lou, who is my agent, one of the few agents whose name isn't Bernie, and he said, they want you to go to work. And, of course, an amazing thrill for me, having, you know, being in and out of employment and not doing anything wildly exciting. And I'd been in L.A. now about 3.5 years since that snowy night in northern Illinois. Got the job on the writing staff of Laugh-In. And that's how it happened. Also, the interesting thing is when you do get on the air or something, get a job like this, you go in there on your first day and you're looking around and it's a show and you say to yourself, I can't believe it. I'm writing for a network television show. After you've been there about 6 months, you look around and say, I can't believe it. These idiots are doing a network television show. So it's like anything else. As you get to meet the people you realize, they're just regular guys, and there's no, there are not, you meet some incredibly brilliant people, but there's also, there are also just regular run-of-the-mill guys that you say, how did he ever get here? So, and I may be one of those guys that subsequently some young guy came on and looked and said, I can't believe this guy is producing this ridiculous pilot. So... That pretty much, now we're into writing.
And now we're into writing. Why don't we take some time off here and listen to some music, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about what happened after Laugh In and On. But you had a theme song besides Crack Home in Indiana.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd pick out, as I say, it was like old times revisited here, when except they're CDs now instead of, as my son calls it, vinyl. And it has been, I think, the last time I stole a jazz album from WFIU is probably in 1962.
There's probably tickets still out there with your name.
and of course, the CDs would be even easier to purloin. But I did, in my show in the one on WTTS, it was called The Jazz Express. I was amazingly creative in those days. And my theme song was, it was Clifford Brown and Max Roach and the quintet, with Harold Land on tenor and George Morrow on the bass, and it had, as you'll hear, it begins, it's Take the A Train, and it starts like a train getting started, and my opening line was from Cole would come on Cole and say, all aboard for the Jazz Express. And then you'll hear the beginning of this, which is a train effect, and then as I was coming near the end of it, I would back cue it, and so that it would end just at the top of the hour, and then I would talk over it, bring that up, and then you'll hear how this thing ends, and that would be the end of my show. So this is Take the A Train.
Well, let's let you give the introduction, and we'll start the music.
All aboard for the Jazz Express.
Okay, John, you got us into Laugh In. Let's go from there.
Okay. After that, it gets kind of monotonous and dull and boring, but that's, isn't that television these days? So, it was fun, but it was, let's see, Laugh In. I ended up doing Laugh In for 4 years, and it was a lot of fun. And the great thing about Laugh In was that because the show was comprised of very short bits and little pieces and things. And so every day we would get an assignment. We would come in. There was a team of five writers. And we worked in these kind of rundown apartment building in Burbank, California, a beautiful downtown Burbank. But at the end of every day, you were finished. You'd get like three jokes, joke wall jokes, two news items of the past, items of the future, a couple blackouts and all this. But every day, basically, you were finished. You could go home, and you were through. So, but subsequently, after that was on for 4 years, and like anything, it gets starts to get repetitive and boring. And how much, how many of these have we done? So, I was anxious to move on and move into half hours then. And so, I was very for the shows that were on the air were. They had things like The Brady Bunch and The Partridge Family, and I guess they were doing early programming for Nickelodeon, and they didn't even know it at the time. So they said, someday there will be cable, and there will be so many stations that we'll be able to take some of the dullest shows ever made and run them all night long on Channel 71. And anyway, but there was also sitcom was starting to take a new turn, and Norman Lear had just put a show on the air called All in the Family. And it was three camera, and it was tape, and it was live, and it was, it was about something. Archie Bunker as the bigot, and based on a very successful English show. So when I went to the William Morris Agency, that's where Lou was, who was a good guy. But the rest of it, and I said, well, Laughing is off the air now. And after that, I also did a Lily Tomlin special. It was the first Lily Tomlin special, which was a terrific experience because she is one of the most inventive people that I've ever worked with. You work with a lot of people, and again, you say, how did this guy ever get in the business? And then you work with somebody like a Lily Tomlin, and you say, this is a mind that is terrific and a good person. So I did that in the interim, but I wanted to get into half hours. And I went to the guys in charge of half hours, the William Morris Agency.
I mean, it was our guys.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, these were short guys. The guys in charge of the hours were a little taller. And, but I said, I want to do half hours now. And they said, okay, fine, we'll set up an interview with you at the Partridge Family, and you can pitch them some shows. Pitch meaning you give them story ideas and hope they will buy one and give you the script. And it was the Brady Bunch, the Partridge Family, that kind of stuff. I said, I don't want to do that. I said, I want to do something like All in the Family or some of the meaningful shows. I think, let's see, this was in 73. So I think even a show, MASH, had already begun. So they said, well, you can't do that. That's where all the big writers are. So subsequently, Lou introduced me to a guy named Don Nickel, who was an English fellow, about 20 years older than I was. We met at a symposium. Again, we hit it off right away. He was a wonderful man. If I had anything close to a mentor, it was Don. And Don was the head writer on a show called All in the Family, which, again, had just come on the air, was a new, and had been on, I think, one or one and a half seasons. And that was, again, a screamingly good number one show. Don said, why don't you come in and pitch, or why don't you come in and pitch some ideas to us? You know, so I came in and pitched, and I wrote, even though you're not supposed to, according to the Writers Guild, you cannot write sample material at their request. You can write a spec script and give it to them. But he said, why don't you just kind of like knock off a couple pages of some Archie dialogue? Which I went home and did some Archie Mike arguments, brought it in. He said, gave it to John Rich, was the producer of the show, and Norman Lear, of course, was running the show. But Norman was now working on a new show that he had created called Maud. I pitched them a few ideas, and they asked me to, they gave me a script assignment, which, again, major thrill. Wrote the script, and upon turning it in, Norman called my agent, said, we want to put him on staff as a writer. And so, again, another really exciting thing. So I signed on, but they weren't planning on adding anyone to the writing staff, so they didn't have enough money in the budget, as if Norman needed money subsequently. So, but this was before the shows had gone into syndication, so Norman only had maybe $30 million to his name. But so because of that, I split time on All in the Family and Maud. And which was just coming on, and worked as a story editor on All in the Family based on this. And then we got part of the job there was to write scripts, and also to this was the first time when scripts were starting to be heavily rewritten by committee, in a sense. It was Don Nickel and a guy, Bernie West, and Mickey Ross, and stuff. It was a small group as it ultimately evolved, because now shows, even like Cheers and things like that, they have. It's called table writing. In other words, it's you give the script to one guy, usually a writer that works for the show or a freelance writer. They work out the story. They turn in the first draft. They get another draft. They bring it in. Then you have table night, in which you now put the script on the table, and you have all kinds of guys coming in that you hire to come in for one night. This is something I subsequently ended up doing for Night Court, because I found this is more fun, because you pay these guys a fortune and they're not killing themselves. They come in one night a week, and we go through the script, and they just throw jokes, try to add jokes and punch it up and polish it and that. But All in the Family was basically the first show that did that. And that's why those shows, I was All in the Family over at NBC. Bud Yorkin, who was Norman's partner at the time, was running a show called Sanford and Son. Again, these were hard laugh comedies. These were funny. They weren't little polite shows with people called Cindy and Bobby in them. So that was basically it. So from All in the Family, and I did some Maud, and then moved on to The Odd Couple, which I loved. I had a great time doing that, and I was reunited with possibly Gary Owens is my oldest friend in L.A. and in show business, and a remarkably nice human being. And another man I met in a comedy workshop who was probably about 15 years older than I was, and he had been in local television and dropped out because he was disgusted by the whole thing. His name was Al Molinaro, and we immediately hit it off, and it was kind of like almost like a father-son, older big brother, little brother relationship, and we used to do some stuff together, and I had heard from, I went to something at the TV Academy, and Gary Marshall spoke, and Gary was a pretty young guy at the time. He had just come off of writing for the Dick Van Dyke Show and stuff, and he was doing The Odd Couple. And again, I enjoyed that a lot, and it was fun. And again, with All in the Family was a great show, I thought, and a number one show and a great experience, but it was fraught with tension. We had three of the largest egos in show business history all in the same room. John Rich was producing and directing. Carol O'Connor was starring in it. And again, this was a man who had been a character actor for many years and was getting by and doing well. Suddenly, he got the part of a lifetime, which he was absolutely brilliant. It was that part he was born to play. But then at that point, he was Archie Bunker. And Norman Lear, who created the character, wrote the character, based the character kind of on his father, who owned the character, suddenly, as far as Carol was concerned, Carol knew the character better than Norman. But that's what we deal with actors in you know, in this wonderful business of ours. So there was all kinds of, you know, again, the results were amazing and great. I thought the show went on about 4 years too long because, you know, members kept leaving and Carol was still doing the show. It was ultimately there's a line that comes later on about this, but I don't know if you remember. It was first, I think, Mike and Gloria left, and then ultimately Edith died, and still you had Carol O'Connor. By this time, I think Norman Lear had gone on to do other stuff, and Carol was basically running the show, and it became then Archie Bunker's place.
Right.
And that was in about the ninth or tenth season, and really pathetic at this point, which is a shame, because the first 5 or 6 years or maybe more of All in the Family, it was a television classic, and it was a phenomenal program, and it changed half hours, really, because it became about something. It was topical. It was hard-hitting. It had hard jokes in it, which, as they say, up through the other ones, you know, those were all nice, pleasant shows. So I would just jump ahead now many years. On the last week of MASH, when we were getting ready and grinding down to the last thing, and I was, Burt Metcalf and I were basically running the show, and Burt directed that final episode. So,
but Goodbye, Farewell, and
Goodbye,
Amen.
Farewell, and Amen. Yeah, which was the film, the 2.5-hour movie that ended it, even though it actually was shot at the beginning of the season, but nobody, you know, that really, they don't know it, but we had to for production purposes, daytime purposes, and all that. So we already had that show in the bank, but that's a whole another story. And so we had this big press conference, and we had decided to take the show off the air because it was still doing very well. And a reporter asked me, he said, why are you ending this now, you know, when the show still works? And I said, well, it is personally, and I think Alan felt the same way and most of the cast wanted, I said, I thought this was a good time to go off now while we're still at the top of our game, because I don't want to be sitting here 5 years from today doing Hawkeye's Place. Oh. So my feeling about the final movie, as I say, we really, because of time constraints and things, we did that script before we started. And the last season, we only, again, it's all convoluted, and a lot of this only comes back to me because I was digging out some information on the thing, but we wanted to end it at the end of the 10th season. Stories were getting incredibly difficult to come by because each MASH episode generally had three stories, you know, where it's always at least two. And it was getting, a lot of the stories had come out of early research and conversations with MASH doctors, because truth always gives you better stuff than what you can make up. And so we had something, but CBS, of course, not wanting to kill the cash cow. They tried to convince us to do more. Then there was a writer's strike that previous year. So we had some scripts in the bank, as we say, things that are done, but we can't shoot. And so they convinced us to use with those scripts. And then if we only wrote like 7 more news shows and then the movie, they'd be able to squeeze an entire season out of this. So we did that. But by and large, because we went, Alan was directing the movie, and we all wanted to write the movie. So we basically, of the writing staff, there was myself and Bert and Alan and then three of the writers on the staff. So we divided the whole thing. First, we wrote the story together, and it was we had to then decide what will happen. We knew this is obviously the fact was the truce had been declared. They're all going to go home, and so we constructed the story. Where is everybody? How's everyone going to leave? Things such as one of the big laughs at the table was, how about the only guy that stays in Korea is Klinger? Because he's through the entire series, you know. So how do we do that?
Back well, let's to Toledo, he marry. Yes.
Yeah. So the thing was, the story there was he marries a Korean girl. So that was part of it. And the other things, just you know, the stories that occurred. But I thought, in a lot of sense, that some of the stories weren't really as good as our usual episodes. You know, and we had, of course, we knew the last half hour, no matter what we did, would be, you know, incredibly moving, because just people saying goodbye, just like the final show of Mary Tyler Moore, when they're always Ed Asner saying, I'll cherish you people, and going to the door. You know, when you've got a farewell show, it tugs at you while you're even writing the story and stuff, and you hate to see these people go, and yet you also know that you've got the audience where you want them because they love these people. So, but we had to come up with other stories. And I thought of all of the stories that there was Hawkeye having his nervous breakdown and whatever else was in Margaret with some library book with Charlie. But again, it wasn't that – nothing was all that wildly important. But I thought the story of Charles – and you're talking about the Korean musicians playing right. – was it Mozart? Was it the Trout or something or whatever?
Clarinet Quintet.
Okay, the
of
Clarinet
Mozart.
Quintet of Mozart. I thought that was, I had said, and again, when you're working on these shows, you know, people see a show and they say, I thought it was wonderful. And all I can think about is all that was wrong with it. You know, when I see the reruns, I say, oh, I can't believe we left that joke in and we argued about this. But I always said that I thought the Charles part of it, Charles's episode, was the far and away the best. That would have made the best half-hour show of all the ones we did it, because I thought it was a wonderful, touching kind of thing with when they all got killed and he taught them how to play, and it was a good end. David Stiers was a sensational actor and a real nice guy, which again I think set MASH off. I've been with a lot of shows. I talked about all the the warmth on All in the Family, even though, as I say, the writing staff, the Don and Bernie and Mickey, I love them. And individually, these were pretty good guys and all that. But, you know, on MASH, we just had some really terrific people. And the other aspect is, if you do a sitcom, you hope that you have at least one good actor in your show. And then the rest are kind of TV phenomenon or whatever. Phenomena? I don't want to miss. You can't use bad grammar on FM either. So that's, but with MASH, there were so many good actors on the show. Alan was a terrific actor and a really nice guy and a very talented writer. One of the few actors that writes that you'd actually hire as a writer if he wasn't a star.
Well, he played George Plimpton in that movie. I mean,
yeah, but there he was acting though. Yes. Yeah, but he was pretending to be a writer. Yeah, but Alan was a wonderful writer, and you have fun when you write. I did a script with Alan. Alan was also a great eater. He loved, even though he kept fairly trim, even though I always thought he had probably the worst body of any leading man in years. And that was in The Sensitive. Remember when Cosmo was out with The Sensitive Man was in that season. And Alan, of course, was, you know, one of the early women's libbers and all that. So he was a sensitive guy. But I thought this man had, you know, he had these little scrawny, pasty legs. And it didn't matter. Alan would walk around in his shorts, you know, the boxer shorts. Alan had no ego where that came from. And that was, again, another wonderful rarity to deal with. But Alan, being Italian, whose real name is Alphonse d'Abruzzi, and the name, I said, what's the name Alda? Obviously, his father, Robert Alda, had been a big star. He was the one that changed the name. And I said, what's the name? He said, "There, we made it up. It's an Al and a duh put together. And even though there's another actress now named Alda, there is no last name Alda. It never existed. It's not like if I changed my name to Johnson or Smith, something like that. Alda did not exist until Robert Alda became Robert Alda. So Alfonso d'Abruzzi was still Italian through and through. And his wife was Jewish. So when you worked with Alan, you got the best food. We'd go to his house, and or we'd go to a restaurant, and we'd be working for about half an hour. And he said, "We got to go. We got to eat now. Go to the refrigerator." And Arlene was his wife. There would just be tons of cheese and all kinds of sausage and stuff. So working with Alan was good, but it was hazardous because if I did more than one script with Alan a season, I would weigh about 290. I don't know how he stayed slim doing all this sort of stuff, but he was fun. Anyway, I'm digressing, but it's a Harry Morgan, terrific, a man who's, since the Oxbow incident had been around for years, a wonderful actor, unbelievably funny. It's when you watch him doing those old Dragnet reruns, and yes, you see him in there knowing, now that I know what Harry, he's like this, this 90-year-old pixie. He loves to tell jokes and do this, and he's so marvelously funny and on Potter with the stuff that he would do, those phrases that he would throw in, mule muffins and all that. We ultimately got to the point where we wrote him. He never spoke English on the last, 3 years of the show. Everything, instead of, at the they would think as well, I'll be there at the first cock-a-doodle. So we were blessed. Even even Loretta, even though she didn't want Hot Lips to be the original, the Hot Lips, the slutty Hot Lips, she wanted to be, as they all become near the end of their run, they want to become more beloved, it was a good cast, and we were very fortunate to have that kind of talent all packed into one show. So have I gotten off another?
We're talking about
the last episode. And the Charles thing. Yes, I'm sort of staying on track here. As you can see, this is why I really never wanted to write. Yeah. Because on paper, I see that it's not. Because I'm actually an incredibly logical, orderly person. I'm left-brained and right-brained. So I tend to argue with myself a lot.
Well, why don't we give your left and right brain a chance to catch up with each other, and we'll listen to some more music. What would you suggest?
Okay, what do we have here? I think, again, because one of his theme songs was from the WFIU day, playing Back Home Again in Indiana, which we don't have here, but why don't we take a listen to some Stan Getz here?
Okay, we'll do that. We have just heard of Thee I Sing, played by Stan Getz, a special selection of our guest, John Rappaport.
Yes, Stan Getz and the lovely George Gershwin.
Okay, John, can you tell us a little bit about your birth family and then about your current family to find out how they put up with you all these years?
Well, let's see. I've been divorced 32 times, and my parents abandoned me when I was 2. So, does that pretty much answer the question? I was born in Chicago, and in the second grade, basically moved to Highland Park, Illinois, which is a suburb of Chicago. Had a basically happy and uneventful childhood. I can't think of any strange beatings that I took or anything like that. Totally nuclear family. I have a brother, and my parents remained married my father died recently at 89, and my mother is still alive and well in Palm Springs, and they adored each other. So that doesn't really sound like a recipe for a good comedy writer, right? You're supposed to have all kinds of bad stuff happen to you or grow up in poverty or something like that. So I really didn't fit the qualifications there. The Jewish part, that kind of goes towards the comedy. But other than that, and my current family is, we live in L.A. in Encino, California, which is a suburb of Los Angeles or a part of Los Angeles. And I have a wife, Lee. We have been married since 1976, so we'll be celebrating our 33rd anniversary. I have a daughter, Stacy, from my first, from my, I like to refer to as my practice marriage of 6 years early on, until my current wife was old enough for me to meet and fall in love with, because she's younger than I. And my daughter, Stacy, is in Los Angeles, and she's getting married about another 9 months to a wonderful guy who is the art director for Disney.com. And Stacy is in the business. She recently finished her second year working for the Fox Family Channel. And I had absolutely nothing to do with her getting into show business. It was not anything that I pushed. She originally wanted to be in education and work with children. Then she spent some time as a teacher's assistant and said, not that great. I love kids, but not every day. So she basically got a job apprenticing at Henson Productions and then moved over to the Fox Family Channel. So that's Stacy. She was just turned 30 last week. And then my other, from my current marriage to Lee, we have a daughter, Jamie, who is a junior at IU, a sports marketing major. And because of my ties to IU, the people at the IU Foundation, Kurt Simic and Dick Bishop, they treated us royally, and we just had a wonderful weekend. And Scott just turned 17. He's a senior in high school in the L.A. area. And he came out with us to visit Jamie a year or two ago, the last time. And we come out every year, and my wife then comes out in the spring for Mother's Weekend. Any excuse we can get to come back to Bloomington, we will jump at. And we were walking around campus for about 10 minutes. He said, "Why would anyone want to go anywhere but here?" And he just got his acceptance. We still want him to look around, but he's got his heart set in coming to IU. So no matter how long you can move to L.A., they're out here. And I think it's – I tell friends back there, when you got kids that grow up in Los Angeles, if you can, send them back to the Midwest so that they can meet some human beings.
Just as an ending, you seem to have lived a very comfortable life as a family man and as a child. Is this why none of your shows seem to involve any kind of murders or sex crimes or violent acts or, you know, robberies, except as they show the realities of life, like on MASH, and yet you get across strong statements of basically what, in each of your shows, it seems to me, the belief in the basic human dignity of the human animal?
It's interesting. Again, of course, because I've worked in comedy as opposed to drama, if I had, was working in drama, I might be doing, something like NYPD Blue or what have you. The comedy, and you're right, and of course, MASH, the great thing about MASH was the humanity and the anti-war message that was involved. The other things, I don't know. I mean, you just really, I gravitated to what I thought was funny and what I could enjoy writing that had good, rich characters and that weren't kind of, again, I also didn't do any of the shows about the real sweet, happy families that are boring and dull. So I think I just like to go where they're, and I enjoy drama. And we've just recently completed a screenplay that's there's a little, comedy dialogue in it. But by and large, I learned from doing MASH, I really enjoyed the dramatic aspects of it. And those were some of the more pleasurable things. When you're doing comedy all your life and all that, you like to kind of get serious and, have a few things to say. And that MASH gave me a good opportunity to do some of that. So
that was emotional dramas versus physical drama.
Yeah. Right? And of course there was, in MASH, when the original powers that be at CBS said, it was a show in the second year, you can't introduce a character and have him die. And it was a show called Sometimes You Hear the Bullet. And Hawkeye had a friend who was a war correspondent. He came through, and the script had where he would then go out on the front lines, and he would come back, and he was dead. CBS said, "You can't do that." Basically, of course, they did it. Larry Gelbart wrote the show, and that changed MASH. That's when it became, if you look at the first year of it, it was a kind of a, just kind of a nice, fun show. And then it got real once we got the network.
Well, it was the McLean Stevenson one too.
Yeah, and that was more Larry Gelbart's spite. It says McLean said he wanted to do the show. He said, "I'm going to kill him." The cast did not know he was going to die. in that. That whole last scene was thrown in at the last second. He said, so if Mac thinks he's coming back, he's got another thing coming. Yeah. So the only person that saw the script was Gary Berghoff, saw it just before he walked in to say, plane disappeared over the Sea of Japan. And those were real reactions there because the cast did not know that he was – they just thought he was going back to the States.
As a final question, you have a strong sense of the positive. And what is the code of your life that has made it so much fun?
Well, you know, it's funny. If you asked anybody or my wife about the positive, she would say, what, Mr. Cynic, Mr. Complain about everything? Comedy, basically, as you know, is you can write comedy because it gives you a chance to yell at people, you know, through humor or through sarcasm or whatever it is. So, I mean, I like to think positively and I like to be optimistic about things. But, you know, positive in reality isn't all that funny. You know, they say Mel Brooks said one time, you know, the theory basically is that when comedy is tragedy separated by time and distance. And as Mel Brooks said, he said, the difference between comedy and tragedy, if we're walking down the street and I slip on a banana peel and fall on my butt, that's not funny. But if I'm walking down the street and you slip on the banana peel and die and fall, that's funny. So, you know, I guess that's as good a definition as any. So.
Well, we've run out of banana peels, unfortunately, today. This has been a wonderful experience. Our guest today has been John Rappaport, and we're just so delighted you could spend some time with us while you're on campus. This is WFIU. I'm Bob Willard, and good night.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in October of 1999. Christina Kuzmich, producer. Engineering and editing by Michael Pascash and John Shelton. For WFIU, thanks for listening.